Well, this business about Marley's ghost is dead. Let there be no doubt about that, okay? For a lot of people, this time is all about certain traditions. One tradition in particular is specific to the workplace, that holiday bonus. Although, go tell that to Irish bankers who had their bonus canceled over the weekend. What to do about the poor worker pleading for some sort of mercy around Christmas?
I suppose you want all day off tomorrow, eh? Don't think I'm amused, do you? And I have to pay a whole day's wages. No work.
It only happens once a year, sir.
That's a pretty excuse for picking a man's pocket every 25th of December.
Is that what bonuses do? Pick employers' pockets every December? Well, to find out how broadly bonuses are applied in the U.S. economy, and, you know, aside from some Irish bankers, who, do we weep for Irish bankers? I'm trying to figure that out.
Boy.
Jay, in the control?
No,
do we
right,
do not weep, not weeping for Irish bankers. You know, what is the impact of the pulling back of bonuses around this holiday season? Because it does have an impact on the economy. Viviana Zelizer, a professor of sociology at Princeton University, joins us, author of the new book, Economic Lives, How Culture Shapes the Economy. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
And please excuse me, I did not mean at all to refer to you or anyone in this segment as Marley's ghost or someone like him.
I hope not.
Yep. Louise Story also is with us, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
And let's just note here at the top the reunion of two colleagues here. You actually studied Viviana's work in college, right, Louise?
I was just mentioning that for my senior thesis in college, I loved her work and cited it a lot in my paper.
And I was extremely impressed by Louise's work so early on.
And she's done well, you know?
Yeah, she's done well.
Well, before we give Louise a bonus, Viviana, what is the scale of holiday bonuses in the economy, and how long back does this tradition go?
Well, there's references to a bonus, not a holiday bonus, as early as 18th century, but the Christmas bonus starts expanding in the early 20th century. There's a proliferation of many kinds of money gifts, by the way. Gift cards, money gift cards, Christmas clubs, money orders as gifts, but also Christmas bonuses for workers, not the high-level executives, early in the 20th century.
I remember working in a factory in the 70s in the auto industry and also in the furniture industry and for a lumber yard, getting a Christmas bonus and having a sort of Christmas club program as a condition of that employment. Louise Story, we associate holiday bonuses exclusively with people at Goldman Sachs and high finance. Is that wrong?
You know, it's pretty common across the U.S. You know, something around like 60% of the workforce gets a bonus. But the difference between regular people and Wall Street people is that for regular people, it's usually not that much money. It might be, you know, up to 10% of their pay. Whereas on Wall Street, you know, it's 50, 60, 70% of their pay because the bonuses can be so large.
You know, Viviana Zelizer, the holiday bonus and the sort of Christmas club concept was a way of encouraging savings, both for employers and for workers. So, you know, if you go back to the early part of the 20th century, right?
Absolutely. And what is interesting about the bonus, it is differentiated from a paycheck. So the employer has a lot of more of control of when it's given, how much. And there are cases like the example you just mentioned in your case, which is fascinating. But there's early examples of control of the uses. For example, you know, I have one case or a Minneapolis flour milling company that gave their employees a $25 check. This is 1914. That had to be deposited at a savings bank, and if they didn't do that, the gift check was useless, valueless. So you have, you know, more. You can't tell the worker how to use the paycheck, really, but you can, in some cases, how to use the bonus.
Although Montgomery Ward's used to give employees a Christmas dinner and a basket with a turkey.
Absolutely, those are the early, and there's gold coins, candy, watches, all these kinds of in kind. But that's what shifts.
And I got a ham when I worked for Glass Doctor in Washington State.
Really?
You get a ham every Christmas.
Well, the New Orleans Railways Company, that early 20th century, made Christmas a keep the change day for the conductors. And they could also have a percentage of the fares collected that day. So there's a lot of variation.
That is a great detail. You know, should we put Louise on the spot here, your former student, Viviana? I think we should. What's the Times do as a bonus for you poor?
Well, you know, it's not flush times at media companies, but they do at the beginning of the next year sometimes give out a few bonuses, but you wouldn't find out till January or February. So it does not affect your Christmas shopping.
I see.
I don't get a bonus.
At Princeton? At Princeton, yeah, forget about it. So when did the bonus start to become sort of the whole picture for someone's salary? I mean, in finance, the bonus basically is your status. Your base pay is almost irrelevant. I mean, that's like pocket change. Viviana?
Well, what I found is the change from the bonus from a gift to something that the workers felt entitled. So much so that there are cases of legal suits requesting, demanding the bonus. So this has become very uncomfortable, right? Because if it's a Christmas gift, how can it be an entitlement?
Right.
But by the 1950s, there's a ruling from the National Labor Relations Board that says in one particular case, right, that this could no longer, the bonus, be an employer's discretionary gift, but it was now an expected component of a worker's wage.
That's so interesting. Viviana Zelizer, professor of sociology at Princeton University, author of the new book, Economic Lives, How Culture Shapes the Economy, Surviving Without a Christmas Bonus, there at Princeton University. Viviana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Louise, before we go, one of our listeners called in yesterday about our discussion yesterday about derivatives. So we talked about the margin that banks offer for these derivatives, and we discussed how it's difficult to know what profit the banks are getting. But what we didn't discuss is why there's so little competition among derivatives. And our listeners sort of asked, you should have gotten into that a little more. Why is it that just a few banks control the derivatives industry? Before we go.
This is a legacy. It's gone on a few decades, and it's really because this small group of banks created this market. And this happens in a lot of parts of finance. They put in the technology and the infrastructure, and they make an investment. And so then they get to write the rules. But over time, in most markets, it opens up eventually to competition, and that's what we haven't really seen happen here yet.
And we can look for that same kind of concentration in exchange-traded funds in emerging markets, those kinds of things that are being created now, that same sort of it's concentrated, but then maybe we'll expand later on.
Right.
Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, expecting a bonus sometime in February, perhaps.
No expectations.
Maybe. No expectations. Right. There we go.
If you have your own story to share about bonuses, especially if you've gotten an interesting bonus, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also post at our website, thetakeaway.org. And here's a bonus for you at the website, our free Takeaway iPhone app. Free. You can use it to take videos, pictures, record some audio, send them directly to
us. Pictures of hams.
You could.
Pictures, yeah.
Yeah. Be a reporter for us, and we have a few assignments for you at the website as well. You can get it all at thetakeaway.org.
A goat would be a great holiday bonus. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste. A goat? I'm Celeste Headlee. Yeah. This is The Takeaway. A goat.
A goat.
Okay. I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.